Hello and welcome to the BAM Deep Dives, a podcast series by the Belgian Association of Marketing. I'm Sarah from Imakina, an EPAM company, and I invite experts to come have a chat about some very hot topics in marketing. In each episode, I make them dig deep so they give us practical insights and real-world examples. Today, I'm recording from the BAM Marketing Congress, and I'll be talking with Matt Navarra, one of Europe's most well-known and in-demand social media consultants and media commentators. I hope you're ready. Let's get started. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
If you had to introduce yourself in the form of a tweet, what would it say?
Tweet. Chief geek, social media nerd, event speaker, all-round general social person, I guess. Is that less than 140? It's not 140 anymore, is it? I've got to give it more space.
All right. Thank you for that. Sorry for putting you on the spot. We're going to talk about social media in this, but this is a deep dive and social media is a broad topic. In your fireside chat yesterday morning, you talked about the hot topics in social media. For the people who missed it, what are they?
There's lots been going on in the last year. I think people have been talking a lot about the TikTok ban in the US and where's that going to go. There's been what happens next for, you know, Blue Sky, Threads versus Elon Musk's X, and what will happen with that platform. We've seen a resurgence of LinkedIn has become popular again, but not just with the typical B2B crowd. It's got a lot more to offer. I think AI clearly has been probably one of the most talked about topics in general around the world, not just within marketing and social media, but more broadly. I think the shift towards private social continues, and people's use of social media is changing and has changed. And I think also we've seen lots of discussion around safety and brands' use of social media, as well as specifically social commerce and how brands are understanding how to leverage social commerce and whether that will take off. So there's that and probably a whole list of many other things as well, I think.
It's a lot. Yeah. And, you know, this is only one podcast. I presume we could do an entire series if we wanted to cover all of them. So let's focus just on a few. Yeah, let's start with social commerce.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, social commerce is something that, you know, for years, all of the platforms or many of the platforms have said about, you know, that's the next big thing. That's the place where we're going to generate more of our income, so we're not so reliant on advertising, which most of these platforms are. And we've seen lots of discussion about, you know, Asia's got this big live shopping kind of commerce business industry, and can that be done and achieved in other countries like the UK, Europe, and in the US? And it's been a big question mark. And I think what we've seen in the last 12 months is further developments across many of the platforms, particularly, I would say, TikTok, to kind of push out the potential for social shopping. And so TikTok this year has done many things to kind of inspire merchants and users to engage in social commerce. They built studios for creators in the US so that they can bring brands and creators together. So that it gives them the facility to use professional grade equipment to do brand collaborations. They've had all sorts of incentives and bonuses to kind of make it cheaper for users to buy through the platform, but also for merchants to sell, and offering to handle their logistics and delivery and make it easier for them in that regard. We've also seen the likes of Amazon, which, you know, it was a big question mark for many years. Is it easier for TikTok to become more like Amazon, or is it easier for Amazon to become more like TikTok? Because they kind of both need a bit of each. Mm. You know, and you need the social bit for the discovery of products and all of the things that, you know, TikTok can do really well for them to sell products. And likewise, TikTok needs to have all of that infrastructure like a platform like Amazon has, and wondered whether there'd be a lot of competition there. And actually, it's been interesting that there's still some sort of friendly enemy kind of competition between the two of them. But they, you know, they're still, there's an element of one needs the other a little bit. But we've also seen the likes of Amazon work with Meta and Snapchat and Pinterest to do a new kind of integrations. So you can see a product, an ad in your feed on Facebook, and it gives you real-time information about the availability to buy it on Amazon's platform. And so there's still some sort of cooperation between the two, because they're both getting something out of that relationship. But certainly social commerce is continuing to be important. And live shopping seems to be where the platforms feel there's a huge potential. I think the jury's still out as to how big that will grow, but I think it looks likely that in the next few years we'll see quite a significant push towards growth in that space.
Can you give an example of social commerce done well?
That's a good question. I think part of the problem is that it certainly feels generational. I think that the younger generations are more in tune and kind of receptive to kind of the live shopping experience. I think my generation, I would, you know, I think technically called an older millennial, maybe even Gen X, probably not so interested in the live shopping things. But, you know, many brands have done all sorts of social commerce activity, things like I've seen, one of the things I have seen is use of broadcast groups and broadcast channels by brands, because aside from the social commerce piece, there's also this growth in private social and groups and communities. And so Instagram and WhatsApp and many other channels have launched these broadcast channels where it's just pushing out content and not like the old school pushing it to feed. And so we've seen brands like Gymshark and Nike and Sephora and many others where they're in these big fandoms that they create, these big communities that create, you know, new product drops, you know, Q&As with top creators and celebrities, and having, you know, behind the scenes access and special activations and discounts in these spaces. And also a lot more in-person events. You know, there's been a resurgence of actually people wanting to have that human contact again. And actually, rather than everything being a virtual Zoom kind of thing or a live stream, it's actually an in real life, you know, people get to meet each other activation for some of these brands. And so there's been seems to have been more of a resurgence of that as well by brands. But yes, certainly more of that activity we can expect to see, I think, in the coming years.
Imagine if I were a company or a marketing team and I want to get into social commerce. What is the thing I need to do to get started?
Well, I think often the shortcut into or experimenting with it or to testing the waters for particularly with TikTok, I think, is working with creators. And one of the things I mentioned yesterday was that seems to have been noticed by me and others is that brands have been not only trying to develop their kind of creator collaborations and do more of the kind of influencer marketing stuff, but also bringing creators into the workplace in having them almost on staff in-house for a period of time, like to be able to help them shape their teams and their workflows and to help them with generation of content and ideas for content that feels much more native and actually feels like it would work better for brands in these places, as well as actually handing some of this stuff over to creators for themselves to kind of carry their message for them. And so I think for brands that have less experience with maybe using platforms like TikTok or who have less experience in terms of social commerce, you know, creator collaborations or at least using creators in some way, even if it's just to kind of help in the background, to help them shape their content strategy is one of the ways that you can kind of test the waters. But I think it always still comes back to content and having, you know, storytelling, the art of being a good storyteller is more important than it ever was.
And if you're hearing that, I'm a storyteller at heart. So yes.
People sometimes think of a story, it's like some like long, you know, begin to end. You know, it could be just 30 seconds, but you're going to say what you're going to say, tell them something, and then remind them what you've just said. Or it's going to be, you know, this is where we start. This is something that happens, and then something at the end. You know, just the traditional narrative of a story arc in any post or any content you do is really as important ever. And video is going to continue to be the dominant video format, as much as I think short form video will still remain the kind of go-to. But we've also seen a resurgence of medium and longer form content, because most of the platforms have given people extra time for Reels and for TikTok. So they've gone from like 60 seconds to 90 seconds to 3 minutes, and on some platforms, 10 minutes. Also there's been this push towards back to the main screen on the TV, and YouTube and TikTok and others have really redesigned their connected TV apps. And so that people often, when you watch a short video, it's fine on your mobile. But if you have somebody like a creator, like, for example, I'm trying to think of this Diary of a CEO, or you can think of any number of other podcasts which have like 1-2-3 hour videos, actually it's quite nice to watch that on the big screen. And so there's been this push back to that space, which is great for the platforms because there's more opportunity for advertising and brands love that opportunity as well. Creators have new ways to monetize. There is an incentive to produce longer form content, and again for the platforms, the longer people stay on the platform, that's good for them as well. So there has been that push both from both sides, from the creators and from the platforms themselves for medium to long form content, I think.
More connected platforms as well, the whole omnimodal experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that challenge is also remains, particularly for smaller brands, and that which platforms should we be on? And should we be on every platform? And, you know, should we take? Well, I think, you know, it's an easier decision for a Nike or a Coca-Cola, you know, when with huge budgets, and, you know, why wouldn't you be, you know, and you find the audiences, there's bound to be a customer for those sorts of companies on all platforms. But for smaller companies, I think, and brands, you do have to be a bit more selective. I think, you know, do you really need to be on Twitter? Most people actually, I think most brands spend less than 1% to 5% of their budget on Twitter at its heyday. And now it's even more of a risky proposition. And so does it really matter if Threads wins out versus if Blue Sky does, because it's not a significant part of their budget? I think it's an interesting one for people like me to talk about. But I think for brands, it's, you know, it's an easier one to kind of not be too concerned about. But in terms of picking platforms, yeah, certainly, you know, there is certain types of industries and certain types of brands, it's more important to be on TikTok than it is to be on Pinterest, than it is maybe to be on Snapchat or something else. So I think it really just comes down to what you're selling, what audience you're trying to target, what your capability is in terms of producing content and the size of your team. It's always been the way that it's better to do less well, do smaller amount of content, but do it really well, than try and do everything everywhere all the time and dilute, you know, the quality of things. And I think that challenge will you know, continue forever in social media, trying to find that right balance between the two.
Earlier, you mentioned infrastructure. What's the kind of infrastructure we need to do social well?
Well, I think infrastructure in terms of teams, like workflow and setup and things. I think, again, like when you're a big global brand, you know, you have huge amounts more resources, and that's less of a constraint or a concern. It's more a case of, you know, choosing which things to do and when you want to do them, rather than can we actually do them at all because we haven't got the team or the budget or the resources and the skill set to do it. I think for smaller brands and for smaller companies or even just solo creators, you have to be much more selective. You have to be, you know, have the right tools and know, you know, you can spend £50 on a social media video editing suite tool, you can spend £5,000. And so I think...
How do you choose?
Yeah.
And is it the budget that decides what you choose?
Well, yeah, to some degree, of course. You know, you have to pick what's sustainable in terms of... And also, you know, there's a level of skill. You know, you have to... You can have all the greatest tools in the world, but if you don't know how to use them and if you don't have the capacity to create the content that's with the tools that you have, then it's all pointless. So I think there is an element of having the right skills in the team, having the right resources, right, using the right pieces of kit, having creative collaborations in place, you know, having a mixture of people that are great idea generators and really online all the time. I was saying yesterday about, you know, having someone in your team who's the extremely online person is so valuable. You know, I was definitely that person because, you know, you may not be the brand that can jump on something, can react really quickly, but, you know, if it's just to come up with ideas and to know what's going out on TikTok that day and what's happening in the world, I think that in itself, having someone in your team who is that person, but equally, you need someone in the team who has got the kind of creative skills, who can do the video editing, can do the kind of image manipulation, as well as kind of has the strategic ideas of kind of which platforms to go on and when to post, what to do and things. So yeah, it's quite a tricky thing, which is why I always say that being a social media manager, you know, it's one of the hardest jobs out there, because you have to be still, since the day I started till now, it hasn't changed. You know, you have to be somebody who's good at comms, copywriting, potentially image editing, video editing, strategy, you know, analytics, the list goes on. So, you know, these people are super talented. And when you find a good one, you need to hold on to them.
Very tightly.
Yes.
But you said, you know, for the creative part of the social media team, you say someone like me, but... Not everyone's like you, right, Matt? You have a special superpower.
Well, I think probably you're referring to ADHD. Mm-hmm. I'm always cautious when I mention that label, because I've met quite a lot of people over the last 10 years or more than 10 years who have ADHD. And I've recognized that there are various levels of ADHD. And like, I'm fairly lucky in the sense that my ADHD is mild to moderate, and my subjective grading of it. But then I've met people who have quite severe ADHD, and it's really, really limiting for their career and also in their personal lives. And so I feel sometimes it's a bit, you know, I'm cautious about saying it's a superpower, because it's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think what my reference to that is that I, I didn't know I had ADHD until I was 27, and I didn't believe I had ADHD. And but I knew up until that point in my career, I had lots of bosses at all the previous bosses and all the previous jobs I had. I didn't get on with any of the teams. The bosses didn't like me. They thought I was difficult, and they thought I wasn't doing what I was meant to be doing. I was challenged with the work, but it didn't make sense why I'd be challenged, because I knew I wasn't, you know, stupid. I was, you know, I'd done reasonably well in my academic performance, particularly at degree level, but it just wasn't clicking. And so when I did find out about the ADHD, which was a long process, and then was able to try medication and see how much of a difference it would make, I was lucky that I had an employer at the time, which was the Next Web in Amsterdam, as a director of social. They gave me very limited boundaries. You know, here's the remit of what the job is. We're not going to tell you how to do the job or how you get from A to B. You just figure that out, because we know that that would be better for you, and we trust you. And if you need help, just ask us. Don't, you know, always the question of asking for forgiveness, never asking for permission, kind of mentality.
Yes.
And that enabled me to kind of spend a lot of time figuring out what was it that I was really good at, what was I not very good at, what things, maybe sorts of work should I steer towards and steer away from, and also kind of being able to be quite reflective on like identifying things I'm really, really good at and navigating more to that. And so over time, there are elements of ADHD that for me are a superpower. Like I do TV interviews for the media, and they'll ask me a question about something that they weren't meant to be asking or I wasn't expecting. And for most people, being on a live TV, it's quite scary. Uh-huh. And to get asked a curveball question, you're like, freeze. But with ADHD, kind of like, I've got 27 different ideas in my head. And so I'm quite quickly, and they're like, oh, you know, you dealt with that. And I'm like, yeah, I'm lucky because my brain's firing about 40 ideas a minute. So I think, you know, there are elements like that. And also I'm fortunate in the position that I can pick which pieces of work I do. And when I had a story I told yesterday about Google, and they asked me to do a report and they wanted me to do a project for them. It was one of my first client jobs. And I was like, this is Google. This is a big deal. I got to make sure this works. And they were like, we want you to do a consultancy project, and we need you to kind of produce this report and then come and present this deck. And I'm like, the worst thing you can give me is someone with ADHD is a blank page. And the idea of creating a deck and a report is really intimidating, because I know I have the knowledge and the skill and the experience, but condensing that down to put it onto a page, I find really challenging. So I thought, I'm either going to carry on in this career now and I'm just going to mask, which is what I did before, and not say anything, get anxious and struggle, and then it probably not go very well, or I could just go, do you know what, I'm not going to do this anymore. So I did say to them, I said, look, I'm not going to produce a report, I'm not going to do a deck, I'm not going to do these things you want me to do, which I was thinking, oh God, they're going to say, well, okay, goodbye then. I said, but what I will do is I will find a way to do it my own way to get you the end goal. Your end goal is you want this information from my head and my ideas and my insights and my experience. I will come into your office. You can record me. You can quiz me to death. We can have multiple calls, multiple meetings, but I'm not going to produce. And they were like, absolutely fine. The thing we want is what we don't have, which is what you know that we don't know. And we want to get that from you. How you get that to us, we're not bothered with. And then I think from that point on, that's how I approached it. And it's the same with speaking at events like this. Can you do a keynote? And I'm like, no, I don't want to do a keynote. I need to do a deck. And if I do a deck, that's got a lot of stress and anxiety for me. So I'll do a fireside chat, and you'll get far more and much more interesting from me to talk in the way a fireside chat would be than for me to stand in front of a lectern and do a keynote where there's a lot of anxiety. So yeah, I've had to kind of adapt, and it's worked, thankfully, for me.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that, because not a lot of people want to be open about being neurodivergent. And it's a topic that's actually quite important, because if you're running a company, chances are you have a couple of neurodivergents running around in your business.
Yeah, so I think I'm surprised that people don't talk about it more, in one part, because to me, it's not like I'm just surprised others don't feel like they can talk about that, because I think we should be by now in a place where that, you know, the companies are much more able to adapt the way that people work. And actually, does it matter if someone does it in the specific linear way that they've always done it? Does it just give them the end goal, give them the starting point, give them some basic structure around that, and then let them do it in the way that they do it? Because ultimately, what you're trying to do is just get a certain thing achieved, and it doesn't, the bits in the middle. But I recognize that there are companies that are not always like that. And I think also there's a lot of people that don't recognize that maybe ADHD is an issue for them, and don't know that, you know, that what having ADHD is like. You know, I was trying to describe yesterday, someone said, well, what's it like having ADHD? And I said, well, the best example is me sitting at home. If you imagine you're thinking about something like, oh, I need to put the bin out, or I need to go and wash the dishes later on, and you're thinking that, and you're telling it, you're speaking in your voice in your head, which everyone does once in a while. Well, for me, ADHD is like that, but having eight, nine, 10 of those thoughts, internal monologues, which, you know, could sound quite crazy, but actually it's just lots of ideas and you're kind of trying to cope with chatting to someone, doing a piece of work, and then your brain's going, you should think about this, you should think about that, you should think about this. Until someone said to me, I don't get that. I get that one a day, maybe. And I'm like, oh, maybe I do have something that's not like everybody else. And mm-hmm. so sometimes until someone, you hear someone like me say that's what it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Maybe I do need to have a chat to someone. So yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding. ADHD is not about not being able to have attention and focus. It's actually about having too much attention and too much focus on too many things.
Mm.
And
it's like the meme, right?
Yeah, it's an inability to control it. And it's a lack of self-control. And medication doesn't solve the problem, but being aware of it and making others you work with aware of it and gravitating and steering towards jobs that play to those strengths and identifying what you're really good at. And that's quite hard, particularly for British people, I think. People like, we're not good at saying we're really good at something and what we're amazing at. But you don't need to tell other people that, but to know it yourself and then to steer your job and your career path to those things you know you're naturally good at and things you know you're not going to do well in. And that takes time to kind of figure out, I think, especially for a young marketer, I would imagine.
Speaking of knowing what you're good at and what you're not good at, I agree that ADHD isn't a superpower. What I meant was your superpower is you're really passionate about social media and you have to know what you're good at and what you're not good at. And some companies are just not passionate about social media. Mm. They just have to add it to the mix. Yeah. What would you recommend to those people who aren't passionate about it?
Well, you do need to have a level of passion about anything, you do, particularly for someone like me. If I'm not excited by something, it's very hard for me to get my brain engaged in it. But certainly for brands, you know, the most amount of time that people spend in their average day is now predominantly being online. Online are those doing email, social media, watching videos, you know, doing something to catch up on the news. If you're not present in those spaces, whether it would be in the TikTok feed or in someone's inbox or whatever, then you're kind of like, how do you plan to reach people really realistically? I don't think there's many companies now that I've certainly not come across them. And maybe that's no surprise that they just think social media is a waste of time. I think there are some that are more committed to it and get it, and there are others that feel like it's a tick box, and it's clear to see which ones, you know, the most successful brands clearly absolutely get it, you know, and have the innovative ideas and come up with things that are different from everybody else. And then there's a whole group of companies in the middle that are kind of like, we'll just copy whatever they do and do our own version of it. And then there's a few that are kind of like, oh, we just need to do social. Social's a tick box thing. And I think that for a social media manager or marketer, that's the worst place to be in. I've been in enough companies myself where it's like, it's an add-on, like, you know, that's the social person. The person who likes playing on a computer, they can just do it and they expect the world from them and they give them no resources and there's no real passion anywhere within the leadership team and they're just fighting a lost cause. And when people come to me and say that experience, they say, what should I do? I said, leave. Because you're not going to change. It's very hard. You can spend years in your career trying to fight against that. Often I find it's typical in the third sector, in public sector more often than not, but not always. But I think you can waste a lot of time in your career working for companies like that as a marketer. I think you're better to go somewhere where there is an acceptance and acknowledgement of the importance of social and also an appetite for it. And they're prepared to take risks. You want somewhere that's trying new things, not fearing failure, giving you a chance to kind of experiment has a lot of trust and gives you some autonomy. Those are the places that thrive the best social media managers, but also tell the best stories and understand the platforms and have the best chance of success. But sometimes those companies are hard to find.
Speaking of trying new things, should we all try Threads and Blue Sky?
It depends what your expectations from it are. You know, my first experience of social media was Twitter. That was where I kind of, my entry path into social when I was 2008. And I didn't really understand how to use it and why I would use it. But it later, little did I know, it was going to become the platform for me that grew an audience. By the time I left X, which I quit using it about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I had about 200,000 nearly followers on there. But I think for certain types of business or certain types of creator, it's really powerful, but it's just not what it once was. You know, it's news, sports, gaming, you know, things that are real time discussion, what's going on in the world, all the things we know and remember that Twitter was really good at. You know, Threads and Blue Sky have the potential to kind of replicate that, and to some degree are trying to, although Meta is very keen not to do all the things that, you know, Twitter did that got everybody upset, which is it doesn't want to promote political content or amplify news. It wants to kind of be this safer space. And I kind of think you can't have one without the other. If you want to be a real-time text-based social media platform, you do have to expect that people will want to share news and people will want to talk about politics that's going on in the world. And you need to have an algorithm and a feed that kind of gives that sense of being real-time. And I think Threads is failing significantly on that front. And so it has the great distribution and has all of the kind of potential because of the fact it's a meta product, but it also has all the problems because it's kind of like homogenized and kind of has that kind of like meta touch to it, the Zuckerberg effect on it. It kind of just feels quite hollow and pointless. It doesn't have any personality or edge. It doesn't do anything particularly different from any other platform. I think Blue Sky is a more interesting proposition because not only does it have the Fediverse integration, which I know that Threads has as well, but it also just feels a bit more exciting and a bit more interesting. It feels like old school Twitter. I think it's a more interesting space. But as I said at the beginning, I think that for most marketers, I don't see text-based social platforms being any more popular than they were when Twitter was in its heyday. It was great for top of funnel, great big brand activation, kind of splashy ads and things. But in terms of actually performance marketing, in terms of, you know, converting and purchasing of goods and all those things that marketers want to achieve and things, you know, it never was a significant factor for them amongst them, all of the other choices. And so I don't know if it's as big a deal as to what happens with Threads and Blue Sky as to maybe some of the other platforms, but I think it's still an interesting space to watch.
You mentioned Fediverse. What can you tell us about decentralized social media?
Well,
first of all, what is it for people who don't know what it is?
And do you know what? Even I, at my level, find it hard to explain to some people, but effectively, we're used to social platforms that are centralized. They are run and owned and managed and operated by one company, a CEO, and whatever happens on the platform is the same for everybody else. The rules, same rules, the same tools, the same kind of algorithm, everything's the same. And if you decide to leave that platform, then you leave everything that you put there behind. You can possibly export some of your images and things, but you can't take what you've grown on that platform anywhere else. You can't port it. With the idea of a decentralized platform where if you didn't like the particular way that the platform was using an algorithm to rank your content, you wanted it to be more higher ranking of people that lived in the UK and enjoyed looking at cat photos, then you could pick your algorithm to kind of give you more of that content in your feed. If you want to leave that particular channel or feed and you want to stay on that platform, or maybe not even be on that platform, you can take that following to another federated platform and it carries over. And people can follow you on Blue Sky, but if you're on, say, Mastodon or another platform, if it's integrated, then follow on one, you're following them on the other as well. So it kind of gives much more power back to the end user. It kind of moves away from this central kind of point of control by the platforms and gives the users more ownership of things. And we've seen that, you know, there's Mastodon, there's Threads is a limited integration into Fediverse. We've got Blue Sky. There are some others as well. We're starting to see how that plays out. I think, like I say, for the average social media user, I think it's probably quite lost on them. But I think for the people like me and those that are really into social, they're sort of seeing that that's the direction of travel. And certainly if Meta is having some role in that, you would see, well, they probably are involved for a reason. And maybe that is a sign of the importance of where the direction is with those sorts of platforms.
Before we all jump into the Fediverse, we shouldn't discount LinkedIn, right? Because yesterday you said there's some sort of renaissance ongoing on LinkedIn. What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
A rebirth of what?
I think, you know, there hasn't been a ground-shaking difference. You know, you're not going to turn up, if you haven't been on LinkedIn for 3 years and you're going to turn up and it's like, oh, wow, this is a completely new place. It very much is the LinkedIn that we've all known for years. But I think in terms of the subtle changes over the last few years and also the change in the kind of general ecosystem of social platforms, it has seemed to be one of the bigger winners. You know, I think Reddit's another one that's had a good couple of years, which we can come back to, but it, you know, it's added a short form video feed. It's added a whole host of AI tools that help both marketers and end users and creators as well. People are sharing a broader range of content types and topics than they ever were before. And it also has, it just feels less, you see less experience in your feed of kind of what you might see as toxic social posts. And I think people just still think that you're in the work environment, aren't you? You're kind of like, there's people that might be my future employer. There are people I'm still working with now. I'm kind of on my business casual sort of behavior. So, and that can be quite refreshing when you go to places like X and others, and it's like very much not like that. So I think from that point of view, it feels a nicer space. And also because there's a broader range of content in there and they have the video feed, it feels a more interesting place. And also LinkedIn is not shied away from being, you know, working with publishers or being, you know, a space for news. They have a very big editorial team in each country. They give you the news headlines in their sidebar. And I've seen a lot of clients and friends of mine who've created agencies that are LinkedIn influencer marketing agencies because of the growth and interest in LinkedIn. So it certainly feels like it's benefited from the way social has moved, and also people looking for an alternative place to be if they're not on X. You know, I think that there's an element of that that may have benefited LinkedIn this year. And then, as I say, Reddit has also seen a resurgence. I think that's partly due to its relationship with Google. It's had a good deal with them. It's recognized the importance of how valuable its data is for AI companies. And that's useful. I think the tweaks and optimizations to the platform to kind of make searching better, to just make it a more useful platform. Also, it's kind of seems to have managed the relationship it had with subreddit moderators, which was also highly controversial for a period of time. And I think it's doing a better job than it's ever done before at helping marketers and brands understand how they can use Reddit and make more sense to them. Because it felt like one of those platforms which is a bit harder to get your head around, and it's a bit too much of a risk. I think marketers are coming around to it, and they've done a good job of making that happen.
You mentioned AI being trained off the content of social media channels, but the other way around, AI for us to use, is there anything you're excited about in the future?
Plenty. I use it quite regularly. So I have my weekly newsletter I do on a Friday, Geek Out, and we use AI fairly extensively, I would say. The cover image is always created, or at least mostly created, using generative AI. I create several ideas for email headlines to help improve my open rate, and I will kind of create my own, and then I'll ask the ChatGPT or another tool that I use, Gemini or something else, to give me ways to make them even better, and then to rank them in order of which one it thinks would deliver the best result, and explain why it would do that, and then filters down so I get the best result. And when I've done A/B tests of my own ideas for my newsletter's headline for that week, and then I put in one or two to A/B test against that are completely AI generated, I would say the success rate is 80-90%. The AI beats my ideas.
80%?
Yeah. I think in the last 4, 6, 8 weeks for the weekly newsletter, 8 to 9 times out of 10, when I've tried my own ideas, put the AI ones in, the AI ones have been performed better. We do use it for that. And I also help it to kind of finesse copy. Sometimes I'll write an intro and it's a bit too long, and I'm like, well, I don't want to just say AI write my entire intro, because that's just not what people want. No one wants to read newsletters all AI generated. I certainly wouldn't. But I do ask it to kind of say, keep the tone, keep these key bits of it that I like, but I want you to just tighten it all up. I've been using it quite extensively. I think that there's plenty of opportunities, certainly if you're a brand or a marketer, there's all sorts of, as we were saying earlier, ways to use it in terms of content creation, but also, you know, I think chatbots, it's going to be a significant customer service win, because for years, you know, chatbots have been pretty robotic and not particularly that useful, and didn't feel very human, and it's just a pain. Whereas I think now the advent of AI and generative AI and chatbots, that's a completely different experience. So that's a new opportunity. I think the thing that's going to be different next year that seems to be very promising for me anyway, and maybe for others, is the idea of AI agents. And so at the moment, you can ask questions of a ChatGPT and say, like, what would be some content ideas for this? Or can you give me some suggestions for that? Or can you tell me, you know, research for this project? And that's all very useful. But what's more powerful for me is to be able to say to an AI agent, where I kind of give it some parameters of, like, focus on marketing, these are sources I want you to use, and these are the tools that I use, and integrate all of that into one personalized AI agent, and say, right, every week I want you to go to Reddit, to this subreddit, and I want you to pick the top three posts, and I want you to take those posts and I want you to put it in a Google Doc. Here's the Google Doc. And when you've done that, I want you to email to tell me it's in there, and then give me your advice on how best to kind of create content for those three ideas. So it's having to do multiple things and then put it all together and take actions and then repeat that scheduled. That is a much more powerful tool than just going to ChatGPT and asking a question and giving you some ideas, which is useful. But the idea of have more stages, and it can actually have memory as well, and remember what you've asked it before, and take actions and steps. That seems to me to be quite an exciting proposition.
I recently learned about multi-agents, which is a collection of agents, and that looks really, really scary. So I really hope that's not the near future. We'll be obsolete very quickly.
Yeah, I think the question comes up quite regularly, you know, are the days of a marketer doomed? Are we always going to need a social media manager? You know, is it going to completely take out the need for us? I don't see that, certainly in the short and medium term. You know, I wouldn't say I'm an AI expert at all, but certainly I think they're going to get a lot better than they already are. They're going to do more for us. But as with a lot of these things, it will do some of the things that maybe we either couldn't do anyway, or we could do, but it cost too much, or it took too long, or it's something we didn't really want to do, but it's a job that needs to be done. Or it can help the additive to kind of like enhance what we're already doing. I don't think it's going to do everything, all of it, all aspects of a particular part of a job in its entirety and have no need for any human interaction at all. It will do some in some roles, in some areas, in some businesses, it will be a significant part. For others, it will be a much smaller part. And I think it's going to just free up us to do more of the things that maybe are even more value adding, or do more of these things that we couldn't do before, so we can do greater things at larger scale, more frequently, in a more sophisticated way. So I see them like we're saying superpowers. I think it gives us some of the superpowers that that we probably could quite need sometimes.
So don't fire your social media team just yet.
No, absolutely don't fire your social media managers. Are, you know, they are your PR manager, your analytics, your everything. They do more than enough. If anything, you're giving them a bit of a respite with some AI agents. That would be nice for a social media manager.
All right, we're at the last question, Matt. What can we expect from you in 2025? What's coming?
Goodness me, I haven't even got to the end of the year to think about. I think one of the things that I enjoy doing is, I actually enjoy doing podcasts. I used to do my own podcast, but it was the time it took to produce was quite cumbersome. So it would be good to see if there's a way to kind of bring that back. It's been about 3 years since I kind of did my own podcast. I enjoy speaking at events. And so part of the lovely part of my job is I get to travel a fair bit. And so there's quite a few countries that hopefully maybe an event will pop up and I'll get a chance to go to. So that would be good. What else would I say that I'm going to be doing? I think I'd like to create something with AI that's based around my newsletter. So the newsletter is, you know, a Bible of everything that's gone on in social that week. It literally has everything in there, every news story, every new feature, every change that's happened. And I think it would be quite cool that I could create a chatbot where people could chat to it and say, has Instagram ever tested this type of feature? And when was it tested? And is there any other similar features that thing? And it can go through all of my catalog and then also speak in my tone of voice and use my style of what I write in. So that becomes a useful tool that can be part of my Geek Out suite, because I have a paid community. So that would be good as well. So maybe something like that. An AI Matt Navarro. Yeah.
Indeed, an AI train on all the data that Matt Navarro has put out over the years.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see if it works until it then starts saying something really scandalous and I'm in the news for something terrible, and then I'll just kill the AI.
Well, you're no stranger to being in the news, Matt.
Well, yeah, so far in a good way, but long may that continue. I don't know if AI will keep me out of trouble or get me in trouble. We'll see.
We'll see. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.